My castaway this week is Jack D, comedian, actor and writer. His persona is that of the laconic miserablest. His hit sitcom was called Lead Balloon and his autobiography is entitled Thanks for Nothing. You get the picture. Well, at least part of it. Even though showbiz was in the family, his great-grandparents were in music hall, his early working life was all over the place, from grafting in the kitchens of the Ritz to working in an artificial leg factory. At one point, he even seriously considered the priesthood. He says that his caustic, ironic, sarcastic comedy comes from a sort of realism. You can't escape the dark stuff in life, and my way of dealing with that is to absorb it into my life so that it's no longer worrying for me. You've been married, Jack D, for a quarter of a century. You've been on our television screens for the last 23 years. You've got four healthy children. None of that sounds like there's much to be miserable about.
There isn't, and I'm very blessed. But I still think that comedy is a lens through which I see everything. And I think almost to some extent, the better things go in your life, the more fearful you can become that they will cease to be that way.
You still bother to do stand-up to sell out crowds, and you've been performing stand-up now for around about 25 years. When I watch you do stand-up, there's none of that manic energy that we often see with comedians and stand-ups, which I guess comes from a degree of nervousness. Now, you must also have the nervousness. I'm wondering where you put it.
It's a good question, because side of stage, I just wait for that moment where the nerves subside. Sometimes it doesn't happen until seconds before I go on and I think it's not going to happen. I've got better and better at learning how to get into that zone. There's a huge amount of concentration, to the extent that the day after I often don't understand why I feel so ghastly. It's like a hangover from that amount of concentration. But at the time, hopefully, I'm enjoying it. And if the audience are thrilled with what you're doing, it's as if you've stood on stage and were able to hover 10 inches above the stage and they're that thrilled with it. It feels like being able to fly. And when it goes badly, it feels like you've said you can fly and you can't.
For a lot of Radio 4 listeners, it's very difficult for us to imagine. I'm sorry, I haven't a clue having any sort of life after Humphrey Littleton died. And what do you know, it certainly has. It's sort of gained a new vigour and people are delighted to see you make such a great job of it. Was it nerve-wracking to take it over?
It was, but I think the trick with anything like that is not to overthink it. You can't go on thinking, I've got to be as good as Humph. The man was a legend and brilliant. All I can do is bring what I have to the show. And it's been one of the greatest things in my career. And sometimes I actually have to pinch myself and I think, I'm doing a show with the goodies.
From the sublime to the ridiculous, Celebrity Big Brother, I noticed throughout it, and you won it quite a few years ago now, you always seem to have a guitar in your hand at your lowest moments. Music, it seems to me, is very, very important to you. I'm wondering, this list of eight today, what's been your criteria?
Often when I've heard this show, of course, I think most people have a mental list in the back of their mind of what they would take on Desert Island Discs. But I was surprised when I actually had to come up with a list. The stuff that I listen to all the time isn't necessarily what I wanted to take away with me. What it ended up being was a list of things that I actually genuinely can't imagine never hearing again.
Right.
So they're all very important pieces to me.
Tell me about the first one then.
Well, this is My Back Pages. It's a Bob Dylan song. I'm cheating a bit because it's got a lot of my favourite musicians in. It's got George Harrison, Tom Petty and Neil Young and Eric Clapton and Roger McGuinn. This is a song that I often listen to after a gig, especially in the car. It uplifts me and it just makes me feel brilliant every time. I love this song.
Crimson flames stab through my head, but I am by the track. Countless fires flaming roll, using ideas as my map. Building on edges soon, said I, crying, heated ground. But I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. Half-bred prejudice, leap forth, rip down all hate. Younger than that now.
That was Bob Dylan, George Harrison, Tom Petty, Eric Clapton, Neil Young singing My Back Pages. Jack D led Balloon, which so many people have enjoyed, critically very highly acclaimed. It ran for 4 series on the BBC, and it was about the domestic life of this perpetually grumpy, career-obsessed, egomaniacal, just sort of moderately successful performer.
Rick Spleen, yeah.
Where on earth did you get the idea of that?
Well, everyone says it's based on you, isn't it? And I always had to say, well, he's a terrible comedian. He's a failure. So no, he's not based on me. But of course, that character really was a composite of characters I've observed, especially on the circuit. It's all about your place in the world and about the sense of disappointment as you get older. And what's interesting is that although a lot of comedians have enjoyed it and said so, it's often their spouses that have said, I really love that show. You got it so right, what it's like at home with a comedian.
What is it like living with a comedian? How could you sum it up?
Well, if you were to ask my wife, I think she would say that, you know, when I'm working, it's very difficult to contact me, you know, emotionally, I'm afraid to say. I'm going to think that's, she's always saying, oh, you're on a different planet, so I'm not going to talk to you today, you know, we'll just leave this and we'll discuss it when you're back on Earth. It's one of those jobs where you can't ever stop thinking about what you're doing, and it takes quite a lot of change in your emotions and what you're thinking about to get to that point where you can perform on stage. So it's almost easier to stay like that for a bit rather than switch it off.
Your style of delivery, this sort of course, deadpan, bone dry, appearing not to give anything for the audiences concerned, it strikes me it's quite an American sensibility. Where did you begin to find it as a voice? Were you watching American comedy much? Were they your heroes?
I grew up listening to a fair amount of American comedy, as I have to say, but also people like Dave Allen, who brought, I think, a sophistication and an elegance to stand-up comedy that I always particularly admired. And I loved the idea, almost a romantic idea, that the comedian is the guy on a stage in a supper club where there are lamps on the tables and people are having martinis brought to them.
Is that where the beautifully cut sharp suits come from then?
A little bit, yes. And also, when I started out, no one was doing that, and I felt, for me, it was a more honest way of presenting myself, because I started out in the audience. I went to the Comedy Store and had a go, but I started out in the audience, and I was very aware that the people around me in the audience had come in from their day job, and I realised I also had a day job, and so it was dishonest to try and present myself as some bohemian character who'd come out of nowhere. I was actually just a kind of ordinary guy.
Tell me about your next choice.
Well, this is Introducing Tobacco to Civilization, Bob Newhart, and my parents had several wonderful albums of comedy. There was a Peter Sellers one and there were Goons. But I loved Bob Newhart, and it was one of those things where you think, oh, hearing the audience, it really struck a chord with me, and I was always so amazed that someone could stand on stage and be able to say so little and get such a huge effect from his audience.
Yeah. What are some of the uses? Well, you know, since we are getting 80 tons of this stuff. hold on. Are you saying snuff? What is snuff, Walt? You take a pinch of tobacco. and you shove it up your nose, Walt. and it what? It makes you sneeze, Walt. A goldenrod seems to do it pretty well here, Walt. Yeah, Walt, does this tobacco have any other uses, you know, just on the off chance that this snuff of yours didn't catch on right off the bat? the turkeys don't have to eat it by any chance, do they, Walt? You can put it in a pipe. Or you can spread it up, put it on a piece of paper. roll up the paper. Don't tell me, Walt, you stick it in your ear, right, Walt? Between your lips, Walt. Then what do you do to Walt? You set fire to it, Walt. You know, we've been a little worried about you, Walt.
That was Bob Newhart and Introducing Tobacco to Civilization. And Jack, do you wanted to say something else about that?
What's I'm always reminded of when I hear that, and it's interesting to me that when I was about 8 years old, my grandfather showed me, he was an artist, and he showed me a picture of a zebra, which was really just a series of black lines on white paper. And he said to me, look how this artist has created so much with just black lines on, and much of what you see of the zebra isn't there at all.
Yes.
And even at that age, when I heard Bob Newhart, I made the connection and I could see that that's exactly what he was doing
as
well.
It's the space, it's what you leave out.
It's the stuff you don't say as much as what you do say. It's allowing the audience to join the dots and do some thinking for themselves, which is brilliant.
I mentioned in the introduction that on your mother's side, it was your great-grandparents that were in music hall, but your grandparents too were performers then.
Yeah, they were in rep, had unsuccessful careers as actors, and so all of my mother's side were really quite theatrical. My grandfather did everything. He was a bank teller and an undertaker at times. He was a policeman at one point. He had all kinds of different jobs. So my mum was, when I first came up with the idea that I might want to be an actor, age 16, 17, her first reaction was, you won't make a living as an actor, because her whole life had been about this feast or famine existence. And so she said, well, if you want to be an actor, you have to get a trade first.
And as a youngster then, you were the youngest of three children. Yeah. Was there quite a gap between you and your
sister? My sister's 8 years older than me, Joanna, and David is 5 years older than me. So I was very much the younger one. And they're all quite loud people, I think it's fair to say. So meal times around the table were usually full of banter and laughter, as I remember.
And you rose to the occasion, did you?
No, I didn't. I think I sat back and observed it all. But being younger, I felt unable to compete in that. But what I would do is take away a lot of it and then use it at school to make people laugh.
And when was the first time that you performed? Were you in school shows? Did you perform as a child?
There wasn't very much drama at the school I went to. I think the very first thing that I remember doing in terms of comedy was my brother and I put on a show one New Year's Eve. There was a big party for the village where we lived. I think I was 11 or 12. It was an Edwardian evening, and we came up with the idea that I would be a ventriloquist dummy and he would be the ventriloquist.
Right.
And so I was dressed up with big rosy red cheeks in a sort of silly suit and sat on his knee like a dummy would. And we went through this routine that we'd rehearsed. And it got a lot of laughs, but there was a man in particular in the front row who became quite helpless with laughter. I mean, it was a fantastic
and you could
dummy.
Just do it. Could
yeah,
you
we could just yeah. do it. And yeah, it just clicked. It felt right and it was instinctive. I remember feeling, I know where this is going. I know how to do this. And it was there are not very many things I think that about in my life.
Let's have your next piece of music, Jack. Do you tell me what we're going to hear now? This is your third of the morning.
Well, I've chosen this because it's genuinely the first piece of music that I was ever aware of. My sister, Jo, played it constantly in her bedroom. This is Petula Clark, Downtown.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown. When you've got worries, all the noise and the hurry seems to help, I know. Downtown, just listen to the music of the traffic in the city. Linger on the sidewalk where the neon signs are pretty. How can you lose? The lights are much brighter there. You can't forget all your troubles, forget all your cares, so go downtown. Things will be great when you're downtown. No finer place for sure, downtown. Everything's waiting for you. Downtown. Don't hang around and let your problems surround you. There are movie shows
downtown. Maybe you know some little places to go to where they never close. Downtown, just listen to the rhythm of a gentle bossa nova. You'll be dancing with them too before the night is over. Happy again. The lights so much brighter there. You can forget all your troubles, forget all your cares. So go downtown, where all the lights are bright.
That was Petula Clark and Downtown, and you said, Jack D, that that really is almost your earliest musical memory.
Almost, but it still resonates with me very strongly because I love cities and the excitement of them, and it's a wonderful song. I never tire of listening to it.
Your father was a self-made man. He did well in, I think it was the printing business he made his money in, and you went to prep school. I've read you say in an interview you hated school so much. I'm wondering specifically what was the problem?
From a very early stage, from about age 8 or 9, I just didn't understand what it was for, any of it. I just didn't understand. I was interested in things, but I didn't want to sit down and actually have to write essays about butterflies and open up frogs and look at them. And part of it was that a lot of the teachers thought I was thick and went to great lengths to tell me I was thick in front of the school on one occasion, the entire school. I got into some trouble and the headmaster addressed me in school assembly in front of the entire school and said that it's very unlikely that he's going to get into a public school because he's too thick. And
are you paraphrasing that?
It's pretty precise what he said. Absolutely. It's what he said in front of the school. I remember him saying that. And you do, of course, you absorb that. As a child, you tend to believe what adults say to you. You tend to believe that. And I think that that was something that I took a long time to shake off. And I still fear that label. I find that one of the most hurtful things that could be said of anyone. So it's not a word I use, not lightly anyway.
You're brilliant, as we see you so often, thinking on your feet and coming back with very caustic, smart-arsed replies. Did you in school to your teachers?
Too much so, I'm sure. I imagine I would have been an absolute pain, in fairness to the teachers. And they weren't all unkind, by the way. Of course, there were some that were great. But I think my ability to learn in the school environment had been well and truly crushed out of me by a pretty early age.
What attitude do you have towards your children and their learning, if you can have sympathy with the fact that kids, smart kids, can be in school and feel very disconnected
from
it?
I think that everyone has a specific kind of intelligence, and a specific talent in their life, and some people have the talent of being able to absorb textbooks and then reproduce them in an exam, and that's a wonderful gift to have, but there are other people who can create amazing pieces of furniture. Now, who's the more intelligent? I wouldn't want to put that to the test.
Did you have the gift of making your schoolmates laugh in school?
I always sought out the people at school that would laugh. Whether I was selecting my audience at an early stage, I don't know. But I had little time for people who didn't have a sense of humour.
What was that driving you? Was it your raison d'etre? I mean, some people, just the best thing they can do is make people
completely
laugh.
Completely. I can remember going to school thinking, what have I got that's funny today? And if I had some new gags or jokes or ideas that were funny, it felt like I had currency.
You got pretty miserable results in your A-levels. What did your parents say about that?
I said, I haven't done very well, Dad. I've failed them all. I'm not going to go any further with it. And meaning university, I said, and there's a long pause. And I said, what do you think I should do now? And he said, well, I should have some breakfast if I were you. And which is a great thing to have said. And it just
That's
took
great.
The curse off it for me. And I think I moved on from there.
And another lesson in comedy timing.
Another great lesson in comedy timing.
Okay, let's have your next disc then. We're on your fourth of the morning.
So this is another kind of comedy memory really for me, which is just sitting at home with the family and watching sitcoms. Dad's Army and Step Turn, some of big favourites. But another one that sometimes I think gets overlooked and the theme tune for it brings back huge memories for me, and I particularly loved this sitcom, was Whatever Happened to the Likely Lads.
Tomorrow's no more.
The theme tune there, Whatever Happened to the Likely Lads, written by Mike Hug and Ian Lafrenais, sung by Tony Rivers with Mike Hug's session band. Jack D, you came out of school and you weren't going to university because you didn't get the results, and you went through a series of, I mean, interesting, unpredictable jobs. Take me through a few of them.
I had a very long period, I suppose it was nearly 8 years, of just drifting around, really, going from job to job. I was delivering incontinence pants all around parts of London at one point for the NHS. Quite a bizarre thing to find yourself that you end up doing.
And the artificial legs?
Artificial legs, that was a summer job when I was a kid. There was a small factory near Winchester, and I used to put these awful artificial legs together, and they were always being sent out to war zones. And so there was the chap who owned the factory would be reading the paper, and if a civil war had started somewhere, he'd step up production. It made his day.
I mentioned that you worked for a time at the Ritz, and I've seen a photograph of that point in your life, and you are wearing whites and a big puffy hat. You look like a proper chef. Were you a proper chef?
I wasn't, no. I actually lied my way into that job because By then, I'd been working in restaurants for a while, so I thought, OK, maybe I'll make a go of this. And so I decided to train myself to be a chef. And I went to college up in North London for one day, and all the memories of being at school came back, and I couldn't cope with being in a classroom. So then I went to the back door, I nearly said stage door, of the Ritz, and said, I've got an interview with the head chef. So they rang down, and the head chef said, I haven't got an interview today. And I said, oh, it's a shame because I've come so far, and I have got the interview. I'm sorry he's forgotten. Anyway, they let me go down and see him, and he agreed. And he knew that I was lying, but he said, if you've got the guts to do that, I'll give you a job. And so I had this horrendous 6 months at the Ritz in the kitchen as this kind of imposter.
What section were you on?
Well, to begin with, I was just up to my arms in lettuce most of the time, but I was just starting in the larder section where you're preparing food for all the other sections, and you're boning joints and
how did you know what to do?
I didn't. I didn't know what to do. So I would tell, I'd ask people, well, how do you like it done here? I mean, obviously I know, but how would you like it done at the Ritz? And so they'd show me. And they quickly realised I was so bad that I got put on the night shift where I had to do room service because they thought I could make sandwiches. But that got more complicated because someone in the middle of the night wanted cauliflower cheese. And I didn't know how to make that. So I got cauliflower. It was actually, I found out later, it was raw cauliflower, and put some pancake mix on it and put it under the grill, and it actually looked quite good, and sent it off. It went up, but it never came back. That was the odd thing. It didn't get sent back.
All right. I wonder how much they paid for that at the Ritz.
I don't know. He probably collapsed with indigestion, the poor bloke.
Being a priest, you properly, really seriously thought about being a priest. How did that come about?
I was becoming increasingly turned in on myself, I suppose, as a way, and depressed. And had turned to religion as a place to kind of hide away from what I was feeling. I felt massively conflicted in what I was doing in my life. I knew I was going hopelessly wrong. It was never going to get anywhere.
What age were you then?
21 or 2, yeah.
So still quite young.
Still quite young. But I had a very strong sense of destiny that was always kind of speaking to me, always saying, what are you doing here? You're in the wrong place. What are you playing at?
And so how far did you pursue the thought that you would go to a seminary and that you would give your life to
God? I got
God?
Quite serious about it at one point because I think I needed it as an alibi, or, you know, a refuge. Yeah, an alibi to say, well, you know, I'm a man of God now. I don't need to do anything else.
Did you talk to your parents about it?
Yeah, I talked to, I'm embarrassed to admit I did. I talked to the priest at St. James's. And he put me forward to be interviewed by the head of the ordinance for the diocese. And I had this interview with this guy. It was just a joke, you know. I didn't even go to church other than to sit there in the afternoon. But I was an amateur theologian, I guess.
And why do you say you're embarrassed?
I'm embarrassed to look back on it, I suppose, because it was folly and I was desperately confused at that time. And it's not even as if I'm a religious person. I would say I'm a person of faith, but I really have less and less time for religion as I grow older.
Let's have some more music then.
This actually reminds me of the very early days on the comedy circuit in the 80s. And it's true to say there was a lot more variety in those days. But John Hegley was a firm favourite for me. And I loved this song that he does called Eddie Don't Like Furniture.
He once got in a rowing boat, they offered him a seat. It was just a strip of timber, but it wasn't up his street. He stood himself up in the boat and made himself feel steady. Then he threw the plank onto the bank and said, furniture, no thank you. Les meubles, non merci. sits on a bonfire, furniture's fine. Anytime that Eddie gets a number 29 bus, even if the seats on top and plenty down below, Eddie almost goes where the pushchairs go. Does Eddie like furniture? I don't think so.
Eddie don't like furniture. Na 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 na. Eddie don't like furniture. Na 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 na.
If you go around Eddie's place and have a game of hide and seek, it isn't very long before you're found. And in a fit of craziness, Eddie took the legs off his dash hound. That stopped him bashing around. Eddie don't like furniture, na 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 na. Eddie don't like furniture, na 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 na.
Eddie don't like furniture.
John Hegley and Eddie Don't Like Furniture. Over the years, Jack D, it seems to me in things that I've read, I've been given the impression that there have been times in your life when you've had, let's say, a tricky relationship with the booze. Mm. Is that fair to say?
Yes, it is, yeah.
When did that start?
I think it became a problem in my late teens and early 20s. And I think that's all tied in with this frustration at not knowing where I was kind of aiming myself in my life, and feeling that I was going in the wrong direction.
And yeah. So when did the moment of clarity come? When did you realise that actually it shouldn't be the sort of the stage of the Ritz or the stage of the pulpit, but actually it should be the stage that you're heading towards?
It was, you know, I'd by then I was working in a restaurant in Covent Garden, and I was surrounded by people who were students at drama school, or they were already actors and or musicians. And one of them said to me one day, and what do you do, Jack? Meaning in terms of performing wise, you know, are you acting and or going to auditions? I said, no, I just work here. And that was really amazing, because they just, I can't believe, what are you talking about? Of course you're on stage. You're always on stage. You're always, you know. And almost in that light bulb moment, the fact that they had assumed that I was one of them made me realise that I always had been one of them. And then shortly after that, I found myself at the Comedy Store, because it was something I'd always intended to do. And I went to see the show, and this new variety of stand-up comedy and performed comedy was emerging. This is 85, so I was quite late to the scene in that respect, and I just couldn't believe it, because I thought they'd started without me. This was the kind of comedy I'd always taken to my friends at school, but I hadn't seen it as anything remotely useful or tangible. And yet here were comedians like Paul Merton and Jeremy Hardy and John Hegley, and they were speaking the language that I felt I'd always spoken, and I just knew I had to be part of it. It really felt like the missing link in my life, yeah.
How did you make the step up onto stage? How did you get your material together? How did you get your first gigs?
To begin with, I didn't. I went, they had an open mic spot on that night, and you can put your name down and go on at the end of the show, which was a terrifying thing to do, but I knew there was no way I couldn't not do that. And the strange thing was, I actually got laughs. I went on, and I was my normal, kind of a quite morose self, didn't put anything into it, and people were laughing. And there weren't really jokes. What I did was purely instinctive, and that's what worked, and it got the laughs. And I can remember going home on my motorbike, actually, and screaming all the way home inside my helmet, thinking, that's it, that's what's wrong with me. I'm a comedian. I didn't, you know, it was ridiculous that I hadn't put two and two together before then. But it was my epiphany.
I love that phrase, that's what's wrong with me, I'm a comedian. Yeah. Let's have your next piece of music, Jack D.
My late manager, Addison Creswell, was when he rang me and said I'd be doing Desert Island Discs. He said, you know, it can't all be Bob Dylan. No, they won't have that. I said, I think you'll find they will, actually, if I wanted it to be. But so I've had one already, and this is another Bob Dylan. And this is a song that I listen to a lot when I'm preparing for shows, because it's got this brilliant sense of defiance about it and wit, and as is his Bob Dylan Maggie's Farm.
Recorded in 1976 at the Hughes Stadium, Fort Collins, Colorado. That was Maggie's Farm, Bob Dylan there. So you got more and more successful and the venues got bigger, Jack D. And then you won the British Comedy Award for Best Stage Newcomer in 1991. In 1992, you were then offered your first TV show. It was Channel 4. Do you remember the moment?
I do, but the commissioning editor got really, really upset. I didn't realise until afterwards. He got really upset that I didn't express any pleasure or excitement at having been given my own TV show. It hadn't occurred to me that I should say, oh, yeah, I'm really excited. But you know,
did you feel any pleasure or excitement?
No, not really. I felt a huge burden of responsibility. It was more frightening than exciting.
You mentioned at points you've realised that depression's been part of your life. Is it part of your life now, or is it pretty much away in a box?
In honesty, it's something that I manage. And I had a point about 14 or 15 years ago where I realised I had to sort of address it more permanently and properly, and since then I have, and it's made a huge difference.
And is performing and going out and doing live gigs part of that? Does that really help you connect with the world?
Yes, it's absolutely is. And in fact, not performing is the problem. If I'm not doing that, I feel completely deprived of something that I need. You just can't. You do that at your peril, because I think that way lies complete madness. If you stop yourself having an outlet, regardless of what it is, if you're creative, you can't ignore that, and it's a pain.
Good, I'm glad you got that out of your system. Yeah. Right, okay, time for some more music. We're on your seventh. Do tell me about this, Jack.
Well, you know, this is... I've done a lot of things. I've been, you know, very privileged to be asked to do things for Comic Relief over the years, and been to Africa on a couple of occasions. And although I have, you know, some issues with the whole thing with aid to the developing world, the experience I had out there kind of changed me. On the last trip, I went to Zambia and saw these kids that had to do a two-hour march to school every day over incredibly rough terrain, very dangerous trip, but they wanted to get to school and have an education. And through the money raised by the British public, a school has now been built in their village, so they don't have that journey in the morning. So their lives are improved immeasurably. And it's only a matter of time before we start meeting those people who've grown up and said, I went to a school that was built by Comic Relief or another organisation, and it changed my life, and now I'm doing this.
Welcome, dear visitors, we are happy to see you now. Welcome, dear visitors, we are happy to see you now. Welcome, 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 we are happy to
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
That was the welcome song sung by the choir of the Mandia Basic School in southern Zambia. So, Jack D, standing in front of those so many thousands of people and doing stand-up and being on the very edge of knowing whether people have found you not just acceptable and reasonable but funny and worth the ticket price, it's quite an extreme place to put yourself all the time. When that teacher said to you, well, you know, you're sick, Jack D, in front of assembly, I wonder if there's a little bit of just replying to that all the time, because you're so verbally dexterous on stage.
Yeah.
Is that maybe what you're doing?
Yes, I think so. Because I achieve nothing at school, really. I'm always trying to subsidise what I fail to achieve through school. And so I'm always reading, I'm always trying to improve my mind. You never give up trying to recapture that ground. And certainly when I'm on stage and if that little voice comes into my head now, it's taking a long time, but if that voice comes into my head saying you're thick, I just say, no, you're not.
No, you're not.
No, I'm not anymore. I know I'm not. You know, I've been able to write and I've been able to perform. I can look after myself.
Cast away and alone on the island, you'll be desperately miserable, won't you?
I like to come up with solutions for problems. And I think that's one of the things that you do a lot of. If you've failed in education, you find other ways through. And whenever I've done camping or anything like that, I've always been quite good at it.
So you would be a man with a plan. I mean, on arrival, you would think, right, I need to find a source.
I think I would, absolutely. Water. I think I'd be building a boat quite quickly.
How impressive. Tell me about your last disc then.
Oh, well, this is a Neil Young song. I love Neil Young. This is a song that is always playing in my mind, because when I've been away on tour and I come back in the middle of the night and the house is all dark and I come indoors, this song is going on in my mind. It's called Good to See You.
Suitcase in your hallway, I'm the footsteps on your floor. When I'm looking down on you, I feel like I know what my life is for. Good to see you. Good to see you again. Good to see you.
Memories of always coming home from all those nights on the road, Jack D.
Yeah.
That was Neil Young and Good to See You. I'm going to give you some books, of course. You get to take the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare and another book of your own. What would you like to take?
I'd enjoy those books a lot anyway, but I would love a really big comprehensive encyclopedia. Just,
oh, fine.
You know, just to keep learning stuff.
Okay, it's yours. And a luxury.
I play the guitar, you know, whenever I can, and I feel very deprived if I haven't got a guitar, so it would have to be an acoustic guitar.
Right. Yes. And finally, of these 8 carefully chosen discs, which one would you save from the waves?
You know, I knew this question was coming, and I still don't know what it is, but there's a part of me thinks I might have to rescue Downtown, maybe because I would enjoy the female company.
It's yours. Jack D, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you, Kirsty.